Hello, Roy here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to The Roy Green Show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Welcome to The Roy Green Show podcast.
We spoke to John Letts about his son Jack's loss of UK citizenship. Listen to that. Daryl Bricker joined us from Ipsos on voter reaction to the Ethics Commissioner's report about Justin Trudeau and SNC-Lavalin. John Nunziata is a former Liberal, then Independent Member of Parliament, on what Jody Wilson-Raybould and Jane Philpott will face from the Liberals during the campaign. From the Canadian Federation of Independent Business, their President and CEO Dan Kelly, and Brian Peck, the former Newfoundland Premier, says Justin Trudeau is playing fast and loose with the Constitution. Big international story today is that Jack Letts, who was dubbed by the British media as Jihadi Jack, has been stripped of his UK citizenship, and the British government says over membership in ISIS, which leaves Jack Letts as only a Canadian citizen. He had dual citizenship because his father was born and raised in this country. His mother is British, and Jack Letts spent most of his life in the UK, but he is a Canadian citizen. When I last spoke with his father, John Letts, Mr. Letts had talked to us about wishing to get his son out of a Kurdish prison and into this country. And Mr. Letts told us at that time that there had been some conversation with Global Affairs Canada about getting his son out of that Kurdish prison and into Canada. What's the situation now? There are media reports that suggest that Canada and the UK are furious with each other over the, or Canada is furious with the UK over the decision the Brits made. Canada says no. But here is a statement that came out of the Office of the Public Safety Minister, Ralph Goodale. The Government of Canada is aware that the United Kingdom revoked the citizenship of Jack Letts. Terrorism knows no borders, so countries need to work together to keep each other safe. Canada is disappointed that the United Kingdom has taken this unilateral action to offload their responsibilities. Investigating, arresting, charging, and prosecuting any Canadian involved in terrorism or violent extremism is our primary objective. They must be held accountable for their actions. The government is aware of some Canadian citizens currently detained in Syria. There is no legal obligation to facilitate their return. We will not expose our consular officials to undue risk in this dangerous part of the world. We are not able to comment on specific cases or national security operational matters. Remember as well that it was this government, the current government of Mr. Trudeau, that enacted Bill C-6 to push aside C-24. C-24 allowed for the rescinding of Canadian citizenship of convicted terrorists who held another country's citizenship as well. Mr. Trudeau passed that legislation. He wanted it. He passed it. So convicted terrorists with Canadian citizenship cannot lose their Canadian rights and their Canadian citizenship. John Letts, the father of Jack Letts, joins us from the UK. John, it's been a while since we've spoken. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us today. Were you aware that your son's British citizenship was going to be rescinded? And if not, when did you find out officially that the decision was taken by the British government?
We found out officially a month ago. A courier showed up and very rudely gave me a package, demanded lots of information from me, and that's when we found out. It only broke in the papers here today, but it's not that it came as a surprise.
What is the reaction, what is your reaction, and what is your wife's reaction to your son's British citizenship being revoked? You told me in our first conversation, which is almost 2 years ago now, that you doubted very much and you challenged the notion that your son had actually joined ISIS.
That's still our position, and I think it's, from our side, even clearer. He never joined ISIS. He's always denied it. When I spoke to you last time, we were in the middle of our trials. It was all contempt of court, and no one wanted to speak to us, so we couldn't speak openly about things. But all that's now finished since the trial's over, so we can talk about what we know about what Jack did, what we do know. Obviously, I haven't spoken to Jack directly in over 4 years, like face, you know, person to person. We've had messaging app messages from just over 2 years ago, and he certainly told us a lot of things then. No, I don't think he ever joined ISIS. I think that he went out there for other reasons, like for his, he was younger, he was a bit messed up. He certainly chose to go to ISIS, and everyone says, well, he chose his route, so now he has to pay the price. Well, he chose to go into ISIS-controlled territory, that's true, although there were hundreds, thousands of groups operating. But he also chose to stand against ISIS. He was put on trial three times by ISIS. They put him on trial in Mosul, for example, because he condemned ISIS as being un-Islamic. He was under house arrest three times. The last time he escaped, and they said, we catch you again, you're going to be killed. And he lost a lot of his friends, because no one really wants to talk about the resistance to ISIS inside Raqqa and other places. So he was in hiding. He was in danger. He lost a lot of his friends. And if I could read you all the messages, the frightening messages, I mean, they're not messages that were made up. They're messages that would upset any parent. So we felt compelled to try to help him. And when we went to trial, we were found, contrary to all the media reports, the way they've spun it, we were found not guilty of sending money to Syria. No one seems to get that straight. Not guilty, because the jury accepted that Jack was trying to escape from ISIS, that he'd condemned them, and that we were under duress to help him save his life. And also, they accepted that the police had told us in writing that we could send the money. However, they did find us guilty of one charge, which was of sending £200, which is about $350, to Lebanon to a poor family who had been a friend of Jack's. But the judge said there is no suggestion that any of this money went for terrorism. But under the Terrorism Act, which is incredibly broad here, incredibly draconian, that they said, well, there was a risk that it could have happened, and that's what we were found guilty of. Now, that's become convicted terrorists, you're sending money to Syria. Well, no, that isn't what happened. So I would like all this information to be able to come out very clearly. Look, I said it to you before, Roy. I'm sorry, I'm not giving you a chance to even breathe, as I did last time, and I said I wouldn't talk so quickly, but it's a really intense issue for us, particularly today. But if Jack has done anything wrong, I will be the first to condemn him publicly. And you know, it was horrible what ISIS did. And there were hundreds and hundreds of groups doing all sorts of horrible things. There were moderate rebels that we trained that did horrible things. You know,
So, John, let me just jump in here for a moment, because I saw a quote from Jack, your son Jack, in an interview with the BBC. Your son is quoted as saying, "I know I was definitely an enemy of Britain." He then also told ITV, "I'm not going to say I'm innocent. If I'm not innocent, I deserve what comes to me." What do you make of that?
I have seen additional bits of those interviews. And I've seen another transcript from ITV where he says, of course I wasn't a terrorist. Now, to me, my view on that is, and I'm not alone in thinking this, Jack was tortured. We know that. Even the Canadians have acknowledged that in a message, that the claim has been made anyway. Clive Stafford Smith is a very, very respected human rights lawyer, set up a group called Reprieve. He worked on a lot of the Guantanamo cases. He's the only person who's gotten in to see Jack in 2.5 years. And he spent an hour with Jack after the interview, and he said, Jack very clearly said, and he said, I believe him 100%, that he was tortured in those before those interviews.
Okay, let me come back to the issue of you and your wife.
That's a very important point. So I dismiss what Jack said in those interviews. I know him. I see him speaking. I knew him for 18 years. I can see his face when he's speaking in fear and telling a little porky, as they say. So I believe he was tortured. So I don't take that as evidence. So as far as I'm concerned, there is no evidence that Jack has done anything wrong. And if there is, bring it forward.
John, you and I, when we last spoke, you told me that Global Affairs Canada had been in touch with your family. And the conversation had been, or the communication had been, about getting Jack out of a Kurdish prison and into this country. Now, the Kurds want to repatriate their prisoners. They've made that very clear. But the Canadian government, if we look at the statement from our public safety minister, isn't particularly, doesn't seem enthusiastic about this. They're accusing Britain of having offloaded their responsibilities, and the minister says the government is aware of some Canadian citizens currently detained in Syria. There's no legal obligation to facilitate their return. So let's start with your conversations with Global Affairs Canada and then your reaction to what the federal public safety minister has indicated.
Well, our conversation started quite a long time ago, and initially they were very positive, and I've got letters in front of me that clearly says that they're having discussions with the Kurds, and you know, we're really going to try to get them out, and we're going to work together to do this. Everything seemed really good. I've got a letter I'm looking at from January 24th, 2018, which says that very thing. We know that they had meetings in the region of critical diplomatic people to facilitate that, and probably other Canadians. And then what we know is that all of a sudden it was like the shutters came down, and we started getting just a stock response from Global Affairs, which was verbatim identical to what the British response was. So our assumption has been that they were just taking orders from the British. And that was upsetting as a Canadian, and but that's basically been the situation, so we've had pretty much nothing. I mean, I went to Canada twice, and again, it didn't really get anywhere. And that's been the situation until recently, and we've now rekindled our contact with the government to say there must be a way that we can work through this. Now, I have that statement in front of me from Ralph Guida, which I've only just got in the last few, not long ago. And, you know, I agree with a lot of it. I agree with they must be held accountable for their actions, and anybody involved in this stuff should be punished. You know, how could I not agree with that? I mean, you know, we all want the country to be safe. I have no idea in a diplomatic sense, you know, what was discussed or not discussed. I think it's quite surprising if there hadn't been some discussions. But again, I'm not surprised by the British government making unilateral decisions.
Are you disappointed by what the public safety minister of this country had to say? Clearly, you want your son to come to Canada.
Well, I think I'll just wait a little bit longer. It seems to be, I don't know what the situation is there. Yeah, I do want him to come to Canada, and I think he can play a role to help. But I think, I don't really know. I mean, we're just kind of reacting to this. We haven't quite planned our next steps.
But you've known for a month that your son's citizenship, the UK citizenship, was going to be revoked. Do you plan to, and you've been to Canada twice, do you plan to lobby Mr. Trudeau? Do you plan to lobby the Conservative Party leader, Andrew Scheer, and the other federal party leaders as this Canadian national election approaches? Do you plan to ask them to get your son into this country?
We have. And of course we will, because every day that we do nothing, he is dying slowly in a jail cell, and we believe he's innocent, and I think he has a right to prove that he is. So yes, of course, we're going to do everything. We're just waiting to see what can be done. I mean, this has now become public. We were waiting to see what was going to happen. Now that we know the landscape, it's a question of how we're going to move forward, and we have lots of people supporting us and supporting Jack who I think could help. So I'm not, you know, specifically, I can't say what's going to happen, but I would like to think that, you know, that the Canadians will have a more, a more careful and more, I suppose, democratic approach to this. I mean, the British, the statement which we've got from the Home Secretary, Sajid Javid, says it's not conducive to the public good that he comes back to Britain. So we have to deprive him because it's not in public interest. But the reasons why we're doing that it's not in the public interest for us to tell you why. So it's the black hole that you can't fight against. There's nothing you can do about it. It's completely unilateral. Well, I think British citizens believe they have certain rights. The truth is you probably don't.
Are you a dual citizen?
Am I?
Yes.
Yes, I am. Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
for work I did in Northern Ireland during the Troubles in the late 90s. And my wife, by the way, has been a full Canadian citizen since she was 14. We're both full Canadian citizens.
All right, since she's a Canadian citizen, one would assume that there would be no ministerial requirement or no permit required from the minister for you and your wife to move to this country if you chose to.
No, we're Canadians. I don't see why that would be necessary, I don't think that's an issue.
Is that a possibility that you would want to move to Canada?
Yeah, the research that I've been doing for 25, 30 years, which is on developing crops adapted to climate change, I think applies to Canada as much as anywhere else. I mean, we have a lot of huge crises to deal with in the world. And I think that work has stands for itself here. So I would consider it. I mean, I love Canada. You know, I'm obviously Canadian. I'm from a small French village in southern Ontario. And, you know, I have many friends there and family, and which I don't get the chance to see very much. And our lives here have been pretty much crushed. They've, you know, destroyed us financially. They've caused immense stress at the family level. So there's a lot of changes that are occurring, and, you know, we are on our knees, really. We're having to leave our flat, our house here that we rent. We're destitute, to be honest, and we're extremely stressed by 4.5 years of being prosecuted. You know, the fact that they could spend £6 million trying to prosecute Sally and I for being dangerous people for sending £200 to a poor family in Lebanon, I think is incredible. If they got that's 10 million Canadian dollars that they spent prosecuting us, I think that could be used much better, a much better way to stop real terrorists.
John, are you facing prison time for this?
No, we've been given a suspended sentence. So that means...
Entirely?
Yeah, we don't have to do anything.
But you had spent time in prison, you did.
I personally spent 6 days in solitary in Wandsworth Prison in London.
Right.
Everyone was a bit shocked, and Sally was in the women's prison in Bronzefield, and it wasn't very nice.
John, I have to ask you this question, and I want to make sure I get this in. Has your son, at any point, to your knowledge, been visited by Canadian consular officials in that Kurdish prison?
As far as I know, no, but I don't know how I would know, because we don't have contact and no one speaks to us. So I have no idea. But, you know, I just want to say something else. He didn't live in Raqqa with ISIS. He lived in Iraq, where he got married and had a child who he's never seen. He fell in love. He kind of, you know, went local and hasn't seen his wife in all that time as well. And she was pregnant when Mosul fell, and he was actually trying to get into Mosul to get her out, and ISIS stopped him. And yet that was spun in our trial to show that he was off with ISIS. No, that wasn't the case. He only ended up in Raqqa because he'd been injured when a house they were living in got bombed, and he almost lost his arm. And the only place I could stitch it up was in Raqqa. And Raqqa was the center of resistance to ISIS, and that's when he got involved in it. He was only in Raqqa for a short time.
But Raqqa was also the capital. It was also the capital of the caliphate.
It was, exactly, which is why it was so dangerous for them to operate. And he escaped from Raqqa before Raqqa fell. So he didn't go to Raqqa to work with ISIS. He ended up there because of his injury. That's our view.
That's your understanding or your view of it. Yeah.
Sorry. Anyway, you wanted to ask me another question.
Yeah. Is your son, do you have any idea whether your son's aware that his British citizenship is gone?
I have no idea. Absolutely. There's no communication. We get a very occasional Red Cross messages, and as I say, they're extremely censored.
So the Kurds have not been in touch with your family at all?
No, everything. I've met the ambassador here in London, or what they call the ambassador. We've tried, but they won't communicate. They're under lockdown. They've been given orders, and we've been told by the Kurds that they're not allowed to talk to us.
They're not allowed to talk to you?
No. The British don't like it.
Have you had conversations, discussions, contact with senior members of the British government who might not be favorably disposed toward your son's citizenship being rescinded?
We know there are some, and yes, we're talking to a few, and it's an unusual situation right now in Britain because of Brexit and what's happening in the Tory party, and it's a chaos at the moment. But there are some very, very senior MPs who are very well respected who think that removing someone's citizenship is wrong. That if, you know, this is actually putting the world at risk. It's not going to keep the country safe and the
okay.
world safe if these people are not dealt with. But fundamentally, you have a right, certain rights as a British citizen, and we know there are a lot of people who feel that way. But the chaos that's going on here with Brexit and everything else seems to push everything off the agenda.
You're Canadian. Your wife is Canadian, has been since she was 14, I believe you said.
Yes.
Your son, Jack, is Canadian. That's his only remaining citizenship now.
And we have a another son who's also fully dual citizen.
Okay. Do you believe that this country has an obligation to unite you in Canada?
I think, well, I mean, there's the legal view that I think we all have a right to go there as Canadians. And I like to think that Canadians appreciate the concept of unifying families who've gone through trauma and who would like to be together in a place like Canada. Yes, I think Canadian values are really important to me. I feel they're very different from some of the values I've lived with in Britain. We're very, very different. And, right. You know, if Jack has done, has in a sense, broken that bond and caused damage to Canadian society or world society and been evil and done all those things, I can see why Canadians would be extremely upset and say, well, we don't have a right to do that. I mean, I have as much a right to be in Canada as any other Canadian who's listening to this story. I've lived here, but boy, everyone knows me as a Canadian. I've done a lot to push Canadian image, I suppose, here and work that I've done. But so I think we all have a right to come back, but if Jack has done something wrong, or any of us, including me and Sally, well then, I can see that someone's got to ask questions about that, and he should be put on trial, and as I keep saying, prosecuted and punished if he has. But I keep saying, I think he actually has, he could actually contribute significantly to stopping young men from going into extremism. You know, he stood against ISIS, that's all I can say. He was a dedicated Muslim, but he believed ISIS was un-Islamic. No one seems to hear it. I keep repeating it. It's like I'm speaking it to a brick wall. But how many times do you have to say it? We can show that in all the messages. He said it himself. But the fundamental way of hearing that is to get him to say it. What if he is? You know, everyone condemns him. They don't know Jack. They know nothing about our case. But I'll be darned if they're not going to send in some tweet or a message comment on an article saying, oh, you know, no smoke without fire. He must be evil. You're in denial. You're in denial. I'm not in denial. I'm not in denial at all. People can change. Kids can do stupid things. People can be brainwashed. I fully understand that. And I keep saying, I will help prosecute him if he's done something wrong. But what if he is innocent? What if he actually did stand against ISIS and was never a member, never did anything wrong, and actually risked his life and lost all of his friends to stop ISIS? Let's just say that's true. Is it right to keep him in a solitary cage in a Kurdish cell where he's dying slowly? He's not been charged. He has no legal representation. What rights do a Canadian have? What makes a Canadian? What makes us different? We have Charter of Rights. We have a Constitution. Does it mean anything? And what if he's innocent? So I spent 1 week in a cell lying on a thin mattress with a little sheet. I was freezing to death. That's all there was, not a book, not a pen. I had no human contact for 5 days. I was freezing. I was in massive pain because of a shoulder injury. I didn't know when. I thought I'd been there for a year. I didn't leave the cell because of the screaming and the violence that I saw in the toilets and heard about. I had inedible food shoved through a hole in the door for 6 days. And then when the judge said release these people, they should never have been inside, they took another day to let me go, and they had to do a writ of habeas corpus just to get me out of a British jail. I mean,
you're comparing that with what you think your son is facing
now. That's nothing to what my son has gone through. I'm his father. Every night I have nightmares about this.
And John, is your UK citizenship in possible danger, right, given you and your wife were found guilty under the Terrorism Act in the UK?
I'm sorry, your voice.
Is your UK citizenship potentially in danger because of the fact that you were found guilty under the Terrorism Act in the UK?
I think any country can probably revoke citizenship of anyone if they decide it in a political sense. I mean, I suppose it would be in danger, and I think the Canadians could probably do it. I have no idea. For sending £200 to a poor family, if that's enough to revoke citizenship, if that makes me a threat to society, well, I've done a lot in 35 years to try to help British society, but I also have worked with some very significant people over the years who think what I'm doing is really valuable to society. So I suppose, yes, Roy, but I don't know if they would do that. I think that would be politically...
You know, I'm seeing emails from people who are very empathetic toward you. You're the dad. You're standing up for your son. You're worried about your son. They get that. They're concerned. They have feelings for you. But I'm not seeing a lot of empathy and concern for your son. And that probably doesn't surprise you.
But why? Well, what is the key point? Because if they say, well, because clearly he was in ISIS, where have they got that information? The tabloid press here, for example, has said, and in the court, when the prosecutors tried to prosecute us, they said, Sally and I were supporters of ISIS, that we tried to funnel money to ISIS to pay for suicide bombers to kill British soldiers, that we're a danger to society, that we set up this international communication system to communicate with our jihadi network, that I ran a training camp at my organic farm in Oxford, a tiny little organic farm, by the way, I rent. I mean, the things that have been said in the papers, people read that and they believe it. So if all these people think Jack is so evil, it's just based on media reports, and people sadly believe what they read, and they don't realize a lot of it is entertainment. I'm talking to you directly. You, thankfully, and I really appreciate you giving me a chance to speak. And they can believe me or not believe me, and I'm sure they can appreciate the fact that I'm a father. They feel for that. Well, then they should feel for the truth as well, because where are they really getting that truth? How do you check that out? Mm-hmm. And all I'm saying is maybe they should let Jack speak for himself. Maybe they should try to find out what the evidence really is before they make that judgment.
All right, John, I have 2 minutes. What level of interest is there in the UK? I know you're going to be on national television in England tomorrow, but what level of interest is there in this particular, in your son's story? It's been front page news for a number of years, on and off, but what's the level of interest now?
Huge interest. I mean, there are scrums of journalists outside the front door all morning, people ringing the bell, trying to talk to us. We just closed the blinds. They keep knocking. It's all over. I'm going to be on a Piers Morgan program tomorrow morning. I mean, we've had 2-3 interviews today, and we don't want to do this. It's extremely invasive, and we're tired of this. We're exhausted. We're emotionally drained, and they come in, and, you know, your life is... How do you feel? It's all very voyeuristic, and we hate it, but we have to do it because we have to keep going because we have to get Jack out or at least give him a chance for some justice. But there's huge interest and huge support from people, family, friends. We've had a big network of people who think that we're losing all of our rights here. You know, they can't just do this to people. And, you know, I'd like to think Canadians are going to feel for that. Maybe they won't.
Well,
nobody cares about anything.
Time will tell.
We're not going to stop because we can't. We're parents, and we're not going to stop.
And John, this story, of course, is gathering, your son's story and yours and your wife's, your family's, is gathering momentum in this country. So there'll be much more said, written, and I'm sure we'll hear more from you. Thank you for coming on the air with me today.
Thank you, Roy. I'm so sorry I go on, but it's really intense.
I think we understand.
It's giving me tense.
We understand. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Take care. John Letts. So the RCMP contacted Jody Wilson-Raybould in the spring. We talked about that some yesterday. We'll do it again today. But they have not contacted her since the Ethics Commissioner's report was released. And Mr. Trudeau, he seems to be saying, well, he doesn't just seem to be saying, he's suggesting very strongly that the problem really is because the Attorney General and the Minister of Justice were the same person. No, I don't think so. I don't think that's the issue. Certainly not as far as the Ethics Commissioner is concerned. What is the long-term impact? And by long-term impact, everything now is pointed toward the 21st of October, the federal election. Does this report and its fallout, and the stories that we've heard explained to us and stressed, does this have the potential to carry through to the 21st of October and seriously and negatively affect the Trudeau government? Daryl Bricker is the president and CEO of Ipsos Public Affairs. He joins us on the Roy Green Show on the Chorus Radio Network. Daryl, thank you very much for the time. And, you know, I found this very interesting the last couple of days, because 3 weeks ago we were saying on the air that SNC-Lavalin, that story really had sideslipped almost off the public radar, and here it is again. How significant is the return?
Really significant. And the reason is because we've really only seen two things that have had an impact on people's perceptions of particularly the major two political parties in this country. One of them was the Prime Minister's trip to India, folded together with the findings of the Ethics Commissioner on the Aga Khan's island trip. And then the second one has been this SNC-Lavalin issue. And it's now reared its ugly head a couple of weeks prior to the government having the issue, the writs issued for the election. So if those are the two big movers, having one of them back on the front page of the newspapers and, you know, leading your show today and leading other, you know, media broadcasts is not good for the government.
Does it have the legs, as it is now, if nothing else develops, does it have the legs to carry through to the 21st of October? If the RCMP gets involved, and if it becomes even more murky and deeper, then obviously it's going to carry through to election date. But as it stands today, does it have the legs to significantly impact the vote on the 21st of October?
Well, potentially it could, because we haven't really heard the end of this, right? The House isn't sitting. So the normal avenues for getting this information out and dealing with it and helping us move on aren't there. The opposition party, the Conservatives, and I think the NDP as well, have asked for the Ethics Committee to sit in order to review the report and to have the Ethics Commissioner appear before them and discuss his findings. Plus, we know, because it's been announced, that Jody Wilson-Raybould's got a book coming out in mid-September, right in the middle of the election campaign. So it's not going to disappear anytime soon. So it makes it very difficult for the government to move on and change the channel if all of these little things keep popping along and pushing it back up to the front page of the newspaper.
Somebody asked me last night, does this have the same kind of potential impact on an election that the Gomery report, that the Sponsorgate issue did in 2011? And I said, you know, 3 weeks ago I would have said no. Today I'm going to say to you, maybe.
Yeah, and I would say maybe too. Nobody likes to see a government under this type of scrutiny with these types of comments being put out there about their character. And as we move into the election campaign, and remember, we're in a period right now in which the government can really dominate the agenda. They have all the advantages of being the incumbent. So scarce media resources are being disproportionately allocated to the government. So it has a better chance of spinning out its story than any of the opposition parties. But the minute that the election starts, probably the first week of September, that's when that starts to even out a bit. So you know that the opposition parties are going to be talking vigorously about this, and the government's narrative is not going to be the one that dominates the conversation. It'll be more even, and when that happens, I can't imagine when a gift is handed to you like the Ethics Commissioner's report that the opposition parties won't be using it continuously through the campaign.
Do you remember a time when a sitting prime minister was convicted of two serious ethics violations?
No, it's never happened before. I mean, I've seen, you know, writing about John A. Macdonald and what happened to him, but I mean, not in the modern era, no. I think the closest analogy we have to this is the Gomery situation and Adscam in the province of Quebec, and we know what happened there.
Right, exactly. So if we can just step away from the SNC situation for a moment and look at what the country looks like now as far as what party support looks like nationally, and then importantly, regionally, what does it look like right now, Daryl?
Well, in our polling, we have the Conservatives ahead by a few points. So they're up, I think around the last poll was 4. But that was before all of this broke. We're in field right now, and we'll be out with Global sometime this week. But Tories had a national lead, but it was distorted by their overall strength in particularly Alberta, but also in Manitoba and Saskatchewan. So the national numbers make them look stronger than they are. And just for your listeners, it's a game of seats. It's not a game of percentage of votes. So if you win seats by huge margins in the province of Alberta, which is what's being shown in our polling right now, that doesn't win you any more seats anywhere else. So you can look really strong in one place and it distorts the national numbers. The big challenge for the Conservative Party and the big opportunity for the Liberal Party is the province of Ontario. Whether or not the Liberals can use Doug Ford as a point of leverage to in particular win the 905, or whether the Conservatives can use the disappointment in SNC-Lavalin and a bunch of other things to push down the Liberal Party in Ontario. So most of this election campaign, we'll talk about the national campaign, but most of it could be fought from buses moving from Montreal through to Toronto.
Yeah. Certainly the Liberals didn't need this particular report from Mario Dion. They're handpicked ethics commissioner, by the way. They didn't need this, and I see no way, Darrell, that this isn't going to be a self-sustaining story at this point.
Yeah, it's like a massive problem that they have not found a way to get beyond. Now they're getting feisty about it. So they're going on this, the jobs argument, which frankly didn't work before. Yep. And now also, if you, follow this on Twitter and other, other places, they're now also questioning the ethics commissioner's interpretation of what his role is. I never see an argument like that work particularly well for the people who are asking those questions, because all you're doing is just trying to win an argument you've already lost, and you're just keeping it in the news.
Exactly. If that's all you've got, you haven't got much.
You really haven't got much. So what the government is trying to do, and they've got some things that they can brag about. I mean, the middle class tax cut is something that they promised and they did deliver on. The economy is running pretty well right now, although there's a lot of, storm clouds on the horizon and Canadians are worried about it. But, the statistics, the objective statistics are generally pretty good. So there's normally, when you walk into an election campaign and you've got a strong economy, that's usually something that you can run on and win.
Yeah.
This time around, there's all of this other stuff going on, but also on the economy, Roy, this sense of impending doom. The feeling that we're in this long, steady decline, and particularly middle-class voters living in the suburbs, feeling like they're not getting ahead, makes it really difficult for the government to brag about that. So where you're going to see this go is where the Liberals have actually been quite successful previously, and that's that they're going to go really hard on the values questions. And things like abortion, for example, or climate change, which is becoming more about the values of the individuals than it is about what's effective for the climate or not. We're going to see a lot of that type of rhetoric going into this campaign as they try to define Andrew Scheer because he hasn't been able to define himself.
Yeah, Mr. Trudeau has some difficulties defining himself. So this is going to be a fascinating, and I'm sure it's going to get to be at some point a down and dirty election campaign. Darrell, always good talking to you. Thank you so much for the time.
Thanks, Ray.
Darrell Bricker is the president and CEO of Ipsos Public Affairs. He's also the author of The Big Shift and Empty Planet, best-selling books. He's written 6 bestsellers. Let's find out whether the Ethics Committee Liberal MPs are going to agree with the opposition parties that the Ethics Commissioner, Mario Dion, should be allowed to appear before the committee. He said he would and could and would do that at short notice. Now we'll have to find out whether we're in for another one of those 5-4 votes. The reality is, their national public profiles notwithstanding, and let's look at this big picture, Jody Wilson-Raybould and Jane Philpott are running for federal election as independent candidates. They no longer have the big red machine providing support. In fact, the big red machine will be doing everything it possibly can to unseat and defeat JWR and JP. So what are the obstacles the Liberal Party will place in the way of Wilson-Raybould and Philpott? And even if they are elected, how influential can they be as a caucus of two? Well, I'm going to be speaking right now with John Nunziata, who I've known for many years. For years, a prominent Liberal member of Parliament, member of the so-called Rat Pack. Nunziata called out Prime Minister Jean Chrétien for not fulfilling the cornerstone Liberal promise to scrap the GST in the 93 election and voted against his party in the first budget bill, and that got him turfed from the caucus where he sat as an independent. Well, back into Parliament, he sat as an independent, then he ran as an independent, and guess what? The Liberal Party, with all of its power, were not able to keep John Nunziata from office. His electorates, his constituents said, no, we like him, and they brought him back. John, thanks for coming on the show. It's always good talking to you. And what is your view, first of all, of the Ethics Commissioner's report?
The Prime Minister should resign. The RCMP should conduct a full investigation In my view, the Prime Minister has breached Section 139, subsection 1 of the Criminal Code of Canada, which speaks to the issue of obstructing justice.
And you're a practicing lawyer.
I am.
And do you believe that the RCMP are actively considering or actively investigating, actively pursuing an investigation at this point?
They confirmed in a statement the other day, Roy, that they are, quote, examining this matter carefully with all available information and will take appropriate actions as required. It would be appropriate for us to provide any more, it would be inappropriate for us to provide any more comments on this matter at this time, the RCMP said. So they are conducting an investigation, and there is sufficient evidence, in my view, to warrant criminal charges against Justin Trudeau.
Wow.
And in the circumstances, we're on the eve of an election campaign.
Yeah.
Let's assume the charges are laid after the election and Mr. Trudeau is successful with the Liberals. I mean, what's going to happen to the government moving forward? Are we going to spend 4 years like they have in the U.S. Dealing with Trump and his alleged breaches of the law?
Quite a question. And it's unusual, isn't it, for the RCMP to say as much as they have said.
And they also said that they will be providing more information. But all you need to do, Roy, is read Section 139 of the Criminal Code and then take the report of the Ethics Commissioner, and you don't need a jury to conclude that this section has been breached. This is what Section 139 says. It says, everyone who willfully attempts in any manner to obstruct, pervert, or defeat the course of justice in a judicial proceeding is guilty of an indictable offense.
John, what do you say to the people who argue that Mr. Dion overstepped his bounds?
Hardly. He's an independent officer of Parliament. This is not the first time he has found the Prime Minister in breach of the Ethics Code. If you recall, some time ago, the Prime Minister was found guilty of breaching the code when he took certain gifts from the Aga Khan, an organization that receives government funding.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't believe he stepped his bounds. It was his authority to his jurisdiction to write the report he did. If anything, he has given the RCMP enough ammunition to move forward with criminal charges. Roy, let's face it, if it was Joe Blow from Kokomo, charges would be laid. So we have to make sure, especially when dealing with the Prime Minister of Canada, there isn't one law for the rich and famous and powerful and another law for ordinary Canadians. And that's what the RCMP are going to have to consider. If they don't lay charges, then that's going to call into question the integrity of our justice system in Canada. And this whole SNC-Lavalin affair has already called into question the fairness of our justice system. When you've got the Prime Minister and his staff trying to convince the Attorney General of Canada not to lay, or at least to persuade the Crown Prosecutor not to lay criminal charges for fraud and bribery.
Yeah, it's a mess. I mean, we've just gone over this so many times, and it becomes more and more distasteful each time you talk about it. John, let's move ahead and get to this issue of that I really want to pick your brain on. We know that Jody Wilson-Raybould is out of the party. We know what happened with the circumstances. We really know as much as they're going to tell us. Jane Philpott followed suit. She stood with her friend and colleague and fellow cabinet minister and questioned the Prime Minister's activities. So if we move forward on the basis that they acted in a principled manner, there are people who don't like those two former cabinet ministers and will challenge that. But what happened to you? When you decided that you weren't going to vote with the Chrétien government on the budget bill because they'd broken their cornerstone election promise about scrapping the GST, they knew you were going to do that. What kind of pressure were you under before that vote?
Oh, tremendous pressure. I had my colleagues fellow MPs, the Prime Minister's office, all trying to convince me that, in effect, that we were going to break our promise to scrap the GST at the time, and it just wasn't the right thing to do, because that's how we got elected in 1993 with a huge majority. The key election issue in that campaign was the GST.
Yeah, I sat with Chrétien in this very studio at the time, and he made that promise with Sheila Copps sitting beside him.
And she ended up resigning after I was forced out of the caucus. Yeah. Because she promised she would resign.
I might have had a little bit to do with that, John.
Yeah. She took.
We kept pushing the Sheila Copps on that. Yeah. So they put pressure on you going into that vote. The pressure was intense on you to not break ranks, but you did.
Well, it was the right thing to do, to vote against the budget, because we made that promise going door to door. And we kept saying to Canadians, unlike Prime Minister Mulroney and the Conservative Party at the time, we do what we say we're going to do, and we don't do what we say we're not going to do. And we all talked about integrity from 1984 to 1993, and that's what caused us to form the Rat Pack and to go after the Prime Minister and his cabinet minister on all kinds of integrity issues.
So when you voted against the government, when you didn't close ranks, did the cold mist descend on you immediately? What was it like in the next 24 to 72 hours for you, as far as your own party was concerned?
What was happening was I was getting a lot of very positive press from all across the country.
Yes, you were.
And other Liberal MPs were getting a lot of negative press for not doing the same thing I did. So they were upset that it was going to cause them some political difficulties because I raised this issue, and it was going to be an issue going into the 1997 election.
See, I don't remember how quickly hurled you out, but might as well. Well, how quickly did they hurl you out of the party?
Oh, it took a number of weeks. I woke up one morning and there was a fax from the Prime Minister, Jean Chrétien, saying that in the circumstances I voted against the budget, showing non-confidence in the budget, that I would no longer be a member of the Liberal caucus. And I said, that's fine.
You were the only one.
And he wished me luck, actually, on national television that day. He said, I want to wish Mr. Nunziata good luck in running as an independent, sarcastically, because he knew it was very difficult to win as an independent. And on election night, the first person I thanked was the Prime Minister.
I remember that. I remember that. John, we have about 5 minutes here, so let me ask you, what's going to happen? What are the Liberals going to do to try to derail the re-election attempts of Jody Wilson-Raybould and Jane Philpott, two former senior cabinet ministers, stars in Justin Trudeau's universe, and now they want to get rid of them? What are they going to do? What did they do to you?
Well, they're going to put a lot of resources in the riding. They tried, they just took the money away that Jane Philpott or Jody Wilson-Raybould had raised and said the money that she raised as a Liberal MP. So they're going to make it as difficult as possible financially for her, because there's no limit as to how much candidates can spend leading up to an election campaign until the writ is issued. So they're going to try their very best to defeat both of those candidates. But I'm fully confident that both Jody and Jane can and will win because of the circumstances of their situation. People are fed up with the Prime Minister, not just because of this issue, but other issues as well. But they're also fed up with party politics, and they understand that we do not live in a democracy. There's a bunch of trained SEALs in Ottawa. They're told what to do. They're not true representatives of the people. And I think we need more independent MPs in Ottawa in order to make that place truly a democratic place. And given the overall political situation, Roy, I wouldn't be too surprised if we have a minority government in the next election. And Jody and Jane and maybe other independents could hold the balance of power.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
and then the liberals will be sucking up to them want their support in order to keep them in power. But I've always urged Canadians that forget about political parties, vote for the best candidate in every riding. And that way you're going to get the best government. Mm-hmm. Because right now our system of government, there was, what, a 68% turnout in the last election?
Which was huge. Really, it's kind of sad, but it was huge.
Yeah, and Justin Trudeau formed a majority government with only 38% of the vote, I believe. That means 62% of Canadians did not vote for the Liberals or Justin Trudeau, but he's given 100% of the power under our system.
Yeah, I think he had 38% of the vote of the 38% of those who voted, but 27% of the entire electorate, because 32% decided not to vote.
That's right. And so Canadians generally, I believe, are disinterested and disengaged in the political process. But if you have more individuals running as independents, I think our system will become more democratic. And the voters of those two ridings, Jody and Jane's ridings, have an opportunity to send a message.
So, John, in 60 seconds, so they're going to make it difficult financially for them because they have much more money that they can throw at it than either Jody Wilson-Raybould or Jane Philpott going independently. What other major challenge are they going to face from their former colleagues?
Well, one of the things they're going to say is, well, an independent doesn't have any power in Ottawa. That,
right.
You know, if you're not a member of the political. But I would rather have my MP vote according to what the best interests are of the riding they represent. And the reality is there are situations that require unanimous support in the House of Commons, and that's how I negotiated a deal with the Speaker and the other parties. I guaranteed myself several questions a week, and I was able to speak on every bill. But you feel truly free and democratic when you can say whatever you want to say in the House of Commons, as
yeah.
opposed to being told what to say by the Leader's Office.
My friend, thank you so much for the time.
Anytime, you
certainly were a thorn in Chrétien's side, and you're much to the appreciation of your constituents, who said, "No, we're not going to send the Liberal candidate back. We're sending Nunziata back to Ottawa." And I love that. I love that. I remember so well that you thanked Chrétien. That was the first person you thanked. Thanks, John.
Okay, Roy, take care.
Take care. John Nunziata, a lawyer in Toronto and a former member of Parliament. He did it his way. So here we are. We're headed toward the election. The writ's going to be dropped shortly. I love that term. I still don't know what it means. Say it goes all the way back to the Magna Carta. But anyway, the writ's going to be dropped shortly, and we'll be in gear for the election. And the Canadian Federation of Independent Business has its 2019 Federal Small Business Platform in place. Now, a couple of facts here. We talk a lot about the entrepreneurs in this country being the principal employers. Think about this. 99.9% of businesses in Canada are small. 99.9% of businesses in Canada are small. 86% are businesses with 5 employees or less. And small and medium-sized businesses were responsible for 85% of new jobs created between 2013 and 2017. No, it wasn't government. And 1 out of 2 small business owners had to stop paying themselves or family members to pay other employees. Got that? 1 out of 2, 50% of small business owners had to stop paying themselves or family members to pay other employees. So as we close in on the 2019 federal election, what is the health of Canada's small business sector? How do international developments affect the small business sector? Like uncertainty, last Wednesday, the Dow down 800 points. That's the fourth largest in history. We have the U.S.-China trade war. Some people say, well, why is that going to bother the small business operator? We're going to find out in a second. We've got hard Brexit, which is going to potentially throw Europe into a economic turmoil. The deteriorating Hong Kong and China relationship. Dan Kelly is the president and CEO of the Canadian Federation of Independent Business. He joins us on the program. Always glad when he does. Dan, thank you for the time. And I knew the number was big, but I didn't know it was 99.9%.
Yeah, no, I mean, lots of Canadians don't know that the vast majority of employers in Canada are small. I think when people think about businesses, they also think about banks, they think about the large retailers, Walmarts, Home Depots, etc. But of course, small and medium-sized firms make up the vast, vast majority of businesses in Canada. And you know, they've been feeling a little neglected, Roy, over the last couple of years.
Well, and they have every reason to. It's been a tough environment for small business operators. They found themselves picked on, if you will, or focused on by the federal government, which has then backed off when they never should have picked on small business operators in the first instance. But also find this just a staggering number. 80% of businesses are those with 5 employees or less. So 99.9% are small business operators, the businesses in this country, 99.9%, and 86% of those are 5 employees or less. That puts the whole issue into perspective. So, Dan, what is it that this group of people who are investing their hard-earned money in their businesses and helping their communities, 50% of them stopped paying themselves and had to pay their so they could pay their employees. What do they most fundamentally need?
Well, I think more than anything, they need a government that is consistent and supportive of small and medium-sized firms. We have had, to be fair, the Liberals have brought in some decent policies for small business. For example, accelerating depreciation from the economic statement last fall. That was a good measure. They've been reasonably good with respect to immigration issues to help small firms address some of the shortage of labor that they are facing. They did, after a big, big fight, they did lower the small business corporate tax rate to 9%. But you know, certainty is a big deal. And for every push, there's been a pull. We've seen Canada pension plan premiums go up over the last couple of years. The new federal carbon tax is in place, causing huge consternation in 4 provinces. The regulatory burden, there's been some steps forward, some steps back on that. And then on the international trade front, the government's not entirely responsible for this, of course, but you know, there are big worries among small and medium-sized firms with respect to what's going on in Europe, our trading relationships with large countries like China, and of course, you know, we're still not out of the woods yet with respect to the renegotiation of NAFTA. There are a few steps left in that saga.
You know, and again, I go back to those numbers, 99.9% and 86%. Clearly, if the Canadian economy is going to survive and thrive and grow, that's the sector that has to be considered and properly appreciated and given an opportunity to continue what they're obviously doing best, and that is invest in their community locally and in the greater Canadian community. There's not only opportunity here, but there's need, and there's demonstrated need to keep these businesses and keep these small operations successful.
Well, and you raise an important point. It isn't just in global numbers why, you know, supporting small business is good economic policy for the country as a whole. It's also good regional economic policy. You know, if we left Canada to the confines of large companies, and again, I don't have anything against large businesses per se, but, you know, when you're in Bathurst, New Brunswick, or in Estevan, Saskatchewan, you're talking about communities that are made up almost exclusively of small and medium-sized companies. Those jobs are there for the long term, as long as the business owner is able to do that. And I've got so many members that have told me that when they're looking to sell, when they eventually have to retire, when time catches up on them, they try to sell as often as they can to people in the local community or to family members, in order to keep the jobs in those communities. We've got lots of business owners that have had offers from, say, the large American company to sell their business, but often the business owner knows that the big company is buying it for its client list, they're buying it for its product or service, and often the jobs would then leave their local communities, and small firms, small business owners, more often than not, say no. So one of the reasons why we've recommended, one of our top recommendations for the 2019 campaign, is for the federal government to allow small firms to sell their business to their family members, to their kids, at the same tax treatment as if you sell it to a stranger. Right now, most people don't know, the business owner is a lot better off if they sell to somebody that they don't know, a stranger,
than if they sell it to their family member, and we think that that's a bad policy. In fact, I was in Burnaby earlier this week meeting with Jagmeet Singh, and the NDP has been very solid in supporting that policy. And to be fair to the Liberals have also commented in the budget that they would consider doing it. We're hoping that we might see all parties make a promise to do that after the 2019 campaign.
And the Conservatives are on board?
We don't know yet. They haven't announced their small business platform. I'm optimistic that that might be a feature of it. But this is what we do at CFIB, is we meet with and talk to all the political leaders, all the parties, to try to get all parties to adopt small business policy. And in fact, in the 2015 campaign, I was super it was a really proud moment for us. All the major parties committed to reduce the small business corporate tax rates to 9%. The NDP actually was the first to announce plans to do that. The Tories, who were in power at the time, then put it into legislation. But the Liberals and Green Party all committed to do that, and we commended all four of Canada's leading parties for doing that. Of course, as you know, Roy, almost immediately after the government was elected, the Liberals were elected, they canceled the plan to reduce the small business corporate tax rates to 9%, then slapped on some incredibly terrible small business tax changes, and only after small business owners rose up and fought back did they reinstate, did they drop some of the worst of those provisions and then recommitted to their promise to lower the small business rates to 9%. It's now happened. It's in law. We're happy with that. But we've always got to be vigilant, even after an election campaign, to make sure that parties are held accountable for the promises they made.
Dan, one of the common denominator issues for everybody, whether it's small business, large business, individuals, families, is putting in place a plan where you actually balance your budget. And if economic concerns continue to grow, and there are economic concerns internationally, that's particularly important. Speak to that, please, and what role that plays in the CFIB's business plan for the 2019 election.
Yeah, it's a really important part of it. People shouldn't be afraid of debt. Debt is something that is used by companies. It's used by individuals when we take out a mortgage on our home, for a home, or a car loan. So we don't want to be religious about this and say, don't borrow, don't go into debt, don't run a deficit ever. At the same time, people also know that eventually you have to kind of pay for your stuff. The bills do come home to roost, and if you run deficits endlessly, you're going to get into giant problems, whether you're running a business, a home, or in many cases, a government. So what worries us right now is that we're not doing that. We wouldn't be worried if we actually had a good, solid plan to get the country out of deficit financing. But we're not even close to that at the moment. And so we're going to be watching all political platforms very closely to see where the parties ultimately land on that. The budgets, though, don't give us much hope that there's no current plan to do that. We feel like over one term, 4 or 5 years, governments should be able to do this. Our worry is, of course, given what you were talking about right before the break about kind of the shakiness of the international economy, if we do, as many are suggesting may happen, if we do run into a big recession sometime soon, is Canada going to be well prepared? And are the social programs that we depend upon for healthcare, education, et cetera, are we going to be able to fund those programs if the economy starts to go into low gear for a while? And we would argue that no, we're not particularly well prepared. Luckily, our debt to GDP ratio isn't terrible at the moment, but we can't afford to let up that pressure, and we do need to balance the budget sometime. I'm hoping it'll be soon.
We really got an idea, didn't we, in 2009, when so much of the world wobbled during that recession that some people even said we might have gone into depression, but they didn't want to use the D word. It certainly was close. And yet Canada did relatively okay. The rest of the world was pointing to us and saying, boy, they're lucky. Boy, they're fortunate. Boy, they're prepared. Whatever it was. Boy, they have natural resources. We were better off than much of the rest of the world. Not so much this time, if it happens.
No, I do worry about that an awful lot, because we have unfortunately been running deficits in good economic times. And the whole theory of deficit financing is that you want to be able to run deficits when the economy's in the skids, because the private sector is not necessarily going to be terribly robust. So government steps in those days with larger spending. But if government's spending its brains out during the good times, there's not much left in the kitty to stimulate the economy in the bad times. And so yeah, that does cause some sleeplessness. And of course, small business owners know that today's deficits are tomorrow's taxes. Ultimately, somebody's going to be paying these bills. We have to be very cautious about all of our new spending programs. And while there is some receptivity to the idea of a publicly funded pharmacare program that both the Liberals and the NDP are talking about, we do have to make sure that we can find one that's affordable, because giant new spending programs means that it's going to be even harder to find our way back to balance in the future.
Yeah. Dan, thank you for the time. Always good talking to you.
Anytime at all, Roy.
Dan Kelly is the president and CEO of the Canadian Federation of Independent Business, the small businesses of this country. If the small businesses are doing well, then the communities are doing well. And by extension, the economy is probably doing reasonably well, or well as well. 99.9% of businesses in this country are small businesses. Back with us is our great friend and contributor to this program, highly overpaid. I don't hear you laughing, Brian.
I'm laughing.
Our good friend, former Premier of Newfoundland and Labrador, Brian Peckford. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very, very good. Personally, as it relates to my own health and stuff, I'm very sad as a Canadian, given what's gone on with the fifth violation of the law by our Prime Minister and his ability somehow to the Canadians don't seem to mind all that much, and I hear very few people asking for his resignation, even though he's broken the law five times. So
let me get to the subject line of your blog piece at Peckford 42 on WordPress. Here it is. Canada has crossed the Rubicon. We are a corrupt nation. Okay. The case is, Brian.
The case is that the Prime Minister of this nation has obstructed justice by interfering with the independent prosecutorial division of the government. He then lobbied wrongly, unconstitutionally, illegally, the minister who had already made a decision to confirm the decision of the prosecutorial division to not entertain a remediation process for SNC-Lavalin, and continued to do that long after the minister had made her decision, and that was a final decision. And additionally, the Prime Minister and his people and his minions were talking to SNC-Lavalin and looking at other alternatives without ever informing the minister herself. So there's a myriad of reasons here. And then we have the Independent Ethics Commissioner adjudicating that what I just said was valid. And yet we find that most Canadians are willing to give the Prime Minister a pass. And this is the fifth time that he has violated the Conflict of Interest Act. And I say, as a Canadian, he does not deserve to be Prime Minister.
You know, it's stunning. When you lay it out the way you just did, and I've heard it different ways, and I've written my own piece, and it all comes back to the nucleus of the issue. You have a serial ethics violator as Prime Minister of Canada, and that is, I'm not laughing because it's funny. It's deeply disturbing. And if I read you correctly, this is not the first time that, and we're not talking just about Trudeau Jr., but we can include Trudeau Sr., where you've seen them to ignore constitutional convention.
Very interesting. When I reread the Ethics Commission report last night, knowing I was coming on your program today, I thought I should read it a second time. And as I was going through it this time, near the end of the report, the Ethics Commissioner references the Shawcross Doctrine, which is the doctrine out of the UK by Attorney General there, which sort of set the standard for independence for prosecutors in governments in the British Commonwealth. And Canada has adopted the things that Lord Shawcross said and has now become the custom in Canada. What the Ethics Commissioner said about this was that the Prime Minister, Trudeau Jr., has violated or ignored a provision, really, of the Constitution, a convention or a custom which has become constitutional. Well, his daddy did exactly the same thing as related to patriation of the Constitution, whereby daddy said, I can go and patriate the Constitution without talking to anybody. The federal government can, I'm the prime minister, we can go ahead and do this unilaterally. Well, the court ruled that there was a convention in this country which was just as much a part of the Constitution as if it was written, saying no, you have to get a majority of the premiers on side to make these kinds of substantial changes to the Constitution. So here we have Daddy Trudeau ignoring the Constitution of Canada, and now we have Trudeau Jr. doing exactly the same thing on another provision of the Constitution. How ironic.
How ironic. And in this case, we have the current prime minister saying the solution to the problem is to separate the responsibilities of attorney general and minister of justice, and then this will never happen again.
That's a joke.
Isn't it?
And that's insulting. That insults me as a Canadian. That insults me as a former first minister of this nation. And I'm deeply offended that the prime minister of this country would have the nerve to suggest such silly window dressing that is going to do. What we need is honesty and in government. That's
right.
What we need, and he has not provided. We need honest people. We must clean the slate and start again in this country.
Okay,
some
Premier.
Other party, some other group to run this country to see if we can get back to some semblance of values and morality coming before politics.
Brian, thank you so much for today and everything, every time you come on the air. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Great.
Thank you very much
terrific.
For having me.
Brian Peckford, the former Premier of Newfoundland and Labrador.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you want to hear more, subscribe to The Roy Green Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorites. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and tell a friend. I'm Roy Green. Have a great weekend.